Chapter 12. Véronique spent a quiet New Year's Day reading and watching TV. She had adjusted to her damaged right eye and reduced vision, and she read a great deal. She went for a walk in the park, all bundled up, and called her father when she got home. She offered to visit him, but he admitted that he was tired and not feeling well. He sounded as though his cough had gotten worse.
"How are you feeling since the surgery?"
he asked. For someone who had been an absentee father for her entire life, since they had reconnected, he had made himself accessible to her whenever she called. He was concerned about her and all that she was facing. He knew she no longer had her mother to watch over her, so he felt it was his turn now, even at this late date. He owed at least that to Marie-Hélène and knew how she adored their child. Losing her had been hard for Véronique, harder than her scars and the career she had lost.
"I feel fine. I want to see how it looks. They keep telling me that it won't be a huge improvement, just a slight one with each surgery, but eventually it won't look quite as shocking as it does now. It is what it is. It won't ever go away completely."
Nor would the trauma of what she had been through. She knew that too, and she got anxious whenever she was in crowds. The airports in Paris and New York had been terrifying for her, but she had managed it anyway. She didn't want it to stop her life, and she was willing to face her demons. The likelihood of anything like it ever happening to her again was beyond remote. She and Dr. Verbier had talked a lot about that, but the memories were still vivid. It had only been 9 months since the attack.
"I want you to come and visit me again," her father said warmly, but he sounded exhausted. It had taken him 2 days to recover from their long visit. "Come and see me when the bandages come off. I'll have gotten rid of this damn cough by then."
"Don't go outside, Papa," she warned him, savouring the word. She loved saying it. It was like a gift he had given her. "It's bitter cold."
"Don't worry. I'm not going anywhere, although the snow looks lovely from my windows. I used to love the snow in Paris when I went to visit your mother. It's such a beautiful city."
"It is." She missed it. New York was an unfamiliar place, even though she had worked there often. But she couldn't imagine living there. It was exciting, but everything about it seemed hard and cold to her. It had none of the charm of Paris. They talked for a while, until his coughing fit stopped him. It was a deep, racking cough that worried her.
"Chip is coming to see me today."
He was her half-brother. He was her father's oldest child and only son. He was 53 years old, 30 years older than Véronique. He had two younger sisters, who were in their 40s. They could have been her parents.
"You sound tired, Papa," Véronique said gently. "You should rest."
"I will. I'm going to take a nap before he comes. You take care of yourself, too. Do what the doctors tell you."
"I do. I've been very careful not to bump anything after the surgery."
The skin was very thin now on her arms and legs since her injuries.
"A nurse comes to check the dressings every day."
"Be careful you don't fall," he warned her. "It must be icy and slippery outside."
He was right. She had almost slipped a few times when she'd gone for a walk.
"I am careful. I'll come and see you soon. I'll call you tomorrow to see how you are." And then she added, "I love you," in her gentle voice. Hearing it brought tears to his eyes. He had missed so much with her, her entire life, and she sounded so much like her mother. They had the same voice.
"I love you too. I hope you know that," he said in a fatherly way.
"Now I do."
"I always did. And your mother. Be careful of the choices you make. We regret our mistakes all our lives."
She didn't know what to say to him, to comfort him. It was clear to her that he regretted not staying with Marie-Hélène and their child. It was too late now, but at least they had found each other and finally met, at the right time for both of them. His wife was no longer there, and she was grateful to have a father, now that she had lost her mother. He was trying to offer Véronique some support in her absence.
"It turned out all right," she said softly. "Maman and I were happy together. She had a good life," she tried to reassure him. There was no point for him to torture himself now.
He was old and sick. Véronique had a forgiving nature. Her mother had taught her that, and had been a shining example of it in her own life. She had been a role model for Véronique in so many ways.
"I'll talk to you soon," he said, his voice fading, and a minute later they both hung up.
She thought about him for the rest of the day and what he'd said. She went to bed early that night after watching a movie. She knew Doug was having dinner with a girl he'd met on the plane coming back from Ireland. She woke up in the morning feeling fresh and energized when the nurse came to change her dressings. Véronique had just woken up, and the nurse put the New York Times on the table next to her, and Véronique went to make a cup of coffee. The nurse left after she'd checked the bandages, and then Véronique sat down with her coffee and the paper. A headline on the front page stopped her in her tracks. It was a photograph of her father when he was younger, and the headline read, "Senator William Hayes dead at 83. Beloved elder statesman died of pneumonia at his home." It said he had passed away the previous afternoon, and she realized with an aching heart that he must have died not long after she spoke to him. She was so glad she had called him. Tears slid down her face as she read the article about his many political victories, the laws he had helped to pass, the vice presidential candidacy that had failed. It said he was survived by his three children, Charles Hayes, who is currently running for a congressional seat, Adele Hayes Harriman, and Elizabeth Hayes Sutton, and seven grandchildren. He had been married to the late Florence Astor Hayes for 56 years, and she had passed away the previous year. The article said he had retired shortly after and had been suffering from ill health for several years. Mrs. Hayes had died of Alzheimer's. They mentioned the senator's many philanthropic activities. He was well known for his generous donations, as was his wife. It listed the numerous Senate subcommittees he'd been on, the important changes he had initiated, and said that he was one of the most respected and beloved members of the Senate. Nowhere did it mention Véronique, or her mother, of course. They were the best guarded secrets of his life that he had taken to his grave. But everything said about him spoke of a noble life, dedicated to improving conditions for others. He had been instrumental in many of the anti-poverty programs, and she found herself wondering if he and her mother had been right to protect him from even a hint of scandal. The obituary would have read differently if a mistress in Paris and a love child had been disclosed, or a nasty divorce for those reasons. The decision not to expose him to that had been made jointly. Yet, from what he said, it was clear to Véronique that he regretted that decision in the end. She would miss him no less now than if he had been her legitimate father. The connection had been made, and even though only recent, their bond was strong. He had arrived in time to be a huge loss to her. She sat, crying, thinking of everything they had said the day before. Most of all, he had told her he loved her, and always had, and her mother, and she believed him. She truly was an orphan now, and she had no one to share the loss with. She knew his death would have broken her mother's heart, and maybe they were together now. She hoped so. His 56-year marriage to Florence Astor had been an empty one, and their last years together couldn't have been easy either if she had Alzheimer's. It was Marie-Hélène he spoke of as the love of his life. The article said that the funeral mass would be in 4 days at St. Patrick's Cathedral and was open to the public. Burial would be private for family only. A rosary was to be said at the cathedral the night before. She sat for hours, staring into space, thinking of him, shocked that he had slipped away so quickly and she hadn't seen him again. She cherished the short time they had shared and their exchanges. She cried every time she thought of him and their conversation the day before. She wondered if he had sensed it was the end. He had been so clear and so insistent when he said he loved her. She was still sitting on the couch with the newspaper in her hand when Doug called her. He had just seen it in the paper. "Oh my God, Vero, I'm so sorry. He has such an impressive background. When did you last see him?" "Not since the last time I was here, when I came to meet him. But we've talked a lot on the phone. I talked to him yesterday and he told me he loved me." She was crying. "I'm an orphan now, for real." She sobbed as she said it, and he felt terrible for her. He told me he was sorry he didn't stay with my mother, but maybe they were right. It would have been a huge scandal. I don't know if they should have braved it or not. But they hadn't, for whatever reason. My mother didn't want to hurt his political future. I guess he had his eye on the presidency, but he never ran for president, just vice president, and lost anyway. He did an awful lot of great stuff if you read the article in the Times. He championed all the anti-poverty programs and was a huge philanthropist personally. You really have to admire him for who he was. There's quite a legacy to have someone like him as your father. I know. I just wish I'd had more time with him, even now as an adult. I was fine with just my mum growing up, although it would have been nice to have him with us. But with my mum gone, he's been very attentive and engaged, and now he's gone too. She'd really had a terrible year, losing both her parents and her father so soon after he came into her life. It's probably stupid, but I'm going to go to the funeral. It's open to the public, so I won't embarrass anyone. No one will even know I'm there, but I want to be there for him. I won't bother anyone or approach his kids. I think my mother would have wanted me to go. He is my father, after all, even if no one knows. It's going to be mobbed. Everyone admired and loved him. But I think you should go, if it's not too hard for you. She'd been through enough without adding more unnecessary trauma, but maybe it would give her some kind of comfort and closure to be there. I wish I could go with you, he said. I have a big shoot on Friday for Harper's Bazaar. I'll be okay, she said, calming down a little. The funeral gave her something to focus on. The nurse took some of the bandages off my face today, and I just have gauze and tape now, so I won't look like a mummy in a horror movie if I go. But I would have gone that way anyway if I had to. He knew she would have. She had shown nothing but guts and courage in the past 10 months. He didn't doubt that for a moment. They talked for a few more minutes after that, and she left the apartment immediately after, bundled up against the cold. She wanted to find something appropriate to wear to her father's funeral. They had buried her mother quietly with a private service that only she and her mother's law partner had attended. This time, she wanted to do her father proud, even if no one in the crowd knew who she was, and she was a secret from everyone who knew him. She was his daughter to her core, and she was going to look it and represent herself and her mother. She took a cab to Bergdorf and began a serious search for something appropriate to wear. She knew all the designers well, and who was most likely to have what she needed, and by 6 o'clock she had found all of it. She was going to be the most quietly elegant woman at the funeral, lost among thousands of strangers and members of the public. She found a beautiful black wool Balenciaga coat from their couture collection, reminiscent of the clothes Audrey Hepburn had worn, and Jacqueline Kennedy. She hadn't brought anything appropriate with her, and didn't own anything quite that grown up, but this was going to be one of the most adult events in her life, and she wanted him to be proud of her, wherever he was now. She found a simple black wool Dior dress to go under it. She was going to wear opaque black stockings so the gauze bandages on her leg didn't show, and very high-heeled black suede Manolo Blahnik pumps, and a plain black alligator handbag her mother would have loved, and a pair of short black kid gloves. The last piece she needed, she knew would be more difficult, but she didn't want to go bareheaded with a large square of gauze on her cheek as the first thing one noticed about her. She wasn't going to wear a surgical mask again, and after trying on every black hat in the store, she found the perfect one by Gucci. It was black felt with a very large brim and a small crown that fit her perfectly. The brim was large, but not ridiculously so. It was very glamorous, in a quiet way, and you had to be as tall as she was to pull it off. She tilted it just slightly, as she would have for a cover shoot. It gave it an extra something, and by tilting it infinitesimally, it almost concealed the bandage on her face, though not entirely, just enough, and drew attention to the left side of her face. The injured right side was slightly in shadow and somewhat concealed by the hat, and made her look elegant and mysterious. It was perfect with the coat and what she'd bought. It all fit perfectly, and she tried it on again when she got home, and was satisfied. She knew what suited her and how to wear it. she would be noticeable in the best possible way as an elegant young woman, impeccably and appropriately dressed for the occasion. She sensed that both of her parents would have been proud of her if they could see her, and she hoped they could. She looked like a model again, worthy of the cover of Vogue. She spent the next 3 days thinking of him, and went to a nearby church to light a candle for him. On Friday, she dressed carefully. She wore a minimum of eye makeup, perfectly applied and barely noticeable, and dressed in what she'd bought. She put the hat on with great care, at just the right angle, and the mirror told her that she had arrived at the right effect when she left with the car and driver she had hired for the occasion. She arrived an hour before the service to be sure she would find a seat in the church. People were quietly lined up to pay their respects. Many had gone to the rosary the night before, but she didn't. She found a seat more easily than she had expected to. With one glance at her, one of the ushers, chosen from his senatorial staff, led her to a pew about a dozen rows behind the family. She looked like someone important who belonged there, and she sat praying quietly, her eyes drifting to the mahogany casket, covered with a blanket of lily of the valley and white phalaenopsis orchids. The church was filled to bursting, and she stood with everyone else when the family filed in, with her half-brother, Charles, in the lead alone, his 3 teenage sons behind him, and Véronique's half-sisters behind them, one with her husband and twin sons, and the other with her husband and a boy and a girl. Their husbands were both bankers, and all of them wore black suits, and the women in black dresses with plain black coats over them. But none had the striking look of Bill's youngest child, in her exquisite hat and coat. They all appeared sober and very sad. The sermon and eulogy were predictably impressive and respectful. 3 of his senatorial colleagues spoke about how important Bill Hayes had been to the country and to them. Charles spoke on behalf of the family, with a moving eulogy to honour his father. Véronique couldn't help noticing that Bill's oldest daughter looked strikingly like her. They had the same tall, slim bodies and similar faces, only Adele was blonde. Elizabeth was shorter and looked more like her mother and had dark hair. Adele had worn a small black fur hat, and Elizabeth was wearing a black lace mantilla that had been her mother's and she had worn to her funeral the previous year. This was a heavy double loss for all of them, just as it was for Véronique in different circumstances. But the loss of both parents was a hard blow, and all of Bill Hayes's children had lost their mother in the past year too. Véronique was seated on the aisle and lined up to take communion. She advanced slowly with the line and stood inches away from her half-brother as she waited near the front of the line, and he sat on the aisle in the first pew. Instinctively, he turned to look at her. She was a beautiful woman. He could barely see the bandage on her cheek with the tilt of her hat, but something about her held his attention as he stared at her. There was something so familiar about her, the way she stood and moved, and even her face, and she was so beautiful that he would have noticed her anyway. Their eyes met for an instant, and everything she felt for her father was in them, and it struck him. He watched as she moved forward to take communion, and on her way back down the aisle he saw the exquisite left half of her face, more exposed than the other side under her hat, and a moment later she had disappeared into the crowd and into the pew where she was sitting. At the end of the Mass, she whispered, "Goodbye, Papa," and threaded her way through the crowd with tears running down her cheeks. Charles saw the hat disappear toward the doors of the church, and then she was gone. She slipped into the car after walking down the steps. Several photographers took her photograph because she looked so elegant and striking, and she hoped they didn't recognize her. She slipped on dark glasses, and once in the car it pulled away to take her back to the apartment, where she carefully took off her hat and coat and sat down in the black dress to read the funeral program again. There was a beautiful photograph of her father on the cover, and the music during the service had been magnificent with the cathedral organ. They had played Beethoven's Ode to Joy at the end and the Ave Maria and Amazing Grace during the service, which had reduced Véronique to tears. Compared to her mother's simple graveside service, her father's funeral was all pomp and ceremony, as suited his stature as a respected senator. After the long emotional day, she wasn't hungry and made herself some chicken broth and toast for dinner. She was at the table in her nightgown after she took her funeral clothes off when the phone rang, and she assumed it would be Doug asking her how it had gone. She felt drained and didn't want to speak to anyone, even Doug. She wasn't going to answer, but the ringing was persistent, and she finally answered the phone. It was from a blocked number. A deep male voice spoke when she answered it. "Miss Vincent?" "Yes?" He sounded serious and somewhat cautious, and the voice was vaguely familiar, but she couldn't place it. "This is Charles Hayes, William Hayes's son," he said as her heart skipped a beat. She couldn't imagine why he was calling her. He sounded so official, she was worried that he was going to threaten her in some way and tell her not to contact any of them, which he wouldn't have anyway. Her mother had been extremely careful and respectful, too. "If convenient for you, I'd like to make an appointment to see you. It was one of my father's last wishes on the day he died." She remembered that he said Chip was coming to see him. She wondered what her father had said to him about her. "Would it be possible for us to meet?" he asked, and she was so stunned she didn't speak for a minute, and then rushed to answer him. "Yes, of course. The service was beautiful, everything about it, the music, the flowers, the tributes. What you said was very moving." "He was an amazing man, and a wonderful father. We were very lucky," he said, "luckier than she was to only have had him for such a short time. Would tomorrow be convenient for you?" "Yes." She had nothing to do, and even if she did, she would have seen him anyway. This was important. She wanted to know what it was about, and didn't want to ask him on the phone. He suggested they meet at the Carlisle, which was convenient for both of them. "At 5 o'clock?" he suggested. "That's fine." He hadn't mentioned his sisters, and she wondered if they were coming too. She couldn't tell if this was going to be a meeting to warn her off and get rid of her, or embrace her as their long-lost sister with open arms. She couldn't guess from anything he said. She wondered if she was walking into some kind of trap, but wanted to go anyway. "Thank you," he said politely. "This meeting was important to my father. He made that very clear to me." "I'm so sorry. I know he wasn't well, but I didn't expect this. Not so soon, anyway." "Neither did we. It's been a shock to all of us. I wish he could have lived to 100. "So do I," she said softly. "See you tomorrow at 5, he said, before he hung up, and Véronique spent the rest of the night worrying about why he wanted to meet her and what he would say. What if he threatened her? But he was so polite and well brought up, that was hard to imagine. He seemed very conservative and formal when she saw him at the funeral. Whatever he said or did, there was no question in her mind. She had to go, even if for no other reason than to honour their father. They had him in common, even if they had nothing else, and never saw each other again after the meeting. Chapter 13. Véronique arrived at the Bemelmans' bar at the Carlisle on the dot of 5. She wore her black Balenciaga coat again, with simple black slacks and a black sweater, and black flats. She didn't feel up to wearing colour. The bandage on her face showed clearly without her hat, but it looked better than what was under it. She had worn her hair pulled back in a bun. She looked younger than she had the day before, and less glamorous, but she still looked beautiful and elegant. She was a striking woman, no matter what she wore. Charles Hayes was already at a quiet corner table, waiting for her, and stood up the moment she walked in. She recognised him too, and made her way toward him, with a small nervous smile, not sure what she was in for. He invited her to sit down, never taking his eyes off her.
"I saw you yesterday," he said immediately, "or I thought it was you. You looked very elegant and very French, and you looked a lot like my sister and paternal grandmother and my dad. I hope I didn't upset you by calling yesterday. My father took me into his confidence the day he died. I never knew anything about you or your mother or even suspected. No one did. I don't think he wanted to take a secret like that with him. And I'm the executor of his estate, so questions would have surfaced eventually. And I think he wanted me to hear it from him. Véronique nodded and listened as he went on. He didn't seem angry at her so far, and wasn't treating her as an intruder. They shared a secret now, which potentially could make them allies, depending on how he viewed it, or enemies if he chose. But he didn't seem hostile. He was very polite and had kind eyes. My parents had a difficult marriage. We all figured that out once we grew up. They weren't well suited to each other. My mother was very distant, even with her children. My father was a much warmer person, and he made up for it. But I never suspected that there was another woman or a child until he told me a few days ago. He told me that he loved your mother very much, and that you had been in touch with him recently, and he saw you. He spoke very highly of her. He smiled at Véronique. This was a difficult meeting for him, too, meeting his father's love child and talking about his mistress. Oddly enough, my mother hated politics and his political career. She always did, and yet he stayed with her. But he told me he didn't want the scandal that it would have caused if he got divorced, particularly if the circumstances surrounding you and your mother came to light. Americans are Puritans and hypocrites sometimes. It wouldn't have gone well with his constituents or played well in the press, even though lots of politicians have affairs and children out of wedlock. Americans expect their political leaders to be above reproach. I'm getting a taste of that myself. I'm in the midst of a divorce. My father encouraged me to do it and not to spend the rest of my life unhappy with the wrong person. He made it very clear to me the other day that he regretted not staying with your mother and risking the fallout of it publicly. He said she left him so she wouldn't spoil his political chances, which was certainly noble of her. She must have been a very good woman, and she never made trouble for my father. Nor did you. Charles smiled at her. She was an honorable woman, and he was a good man. He wanted me to meet you, and we are brother and sister after all. I would have known about you anyway, because I'm the executor of his will, and there's a provision in it for you. She looked shocked when he said it. He wanted to be sure that you'll be all right, with your mother gone and after what happened in Brussels. So he knew all that, too. She was shocked to hear about the money. She hadn't expected that, since he had provided for her very handsomely when he and Marie-Hélène parted. "Do your sisters know about me?" she asked, curious, and he shook his head with a grave expression. He was a serious-looking man, with grey at his temples. My father was specific about that, too. He left it up to me after he was gone, but he didn't think they should. He wanted me to hear it from him directly, which is why he told me that day. I think it's why he asked me to come over. He died only a few hours later, while he was having a nap after I left. My sisters are both very traditional and conservative. They're married, their husbands are bankers. I don't think it would ever occur to them that our father would have an affair or another child. They prefer to believe the illusion of our parents' marriage. I don't think they'd want to know the truth, and they might react badly to it. I have more realistic ideas. My own marriage was a disaster, and I know what it feels like to be trapped in a loveless marriage. I don't blame my father for his involvement with your mother, or the turn it took. In a way, I envy him to be able to say so clearly that she was the love of his life and truly mean it. He had no regrets about her, only about their parting and not staying together. He said he regretted that deeply, and apparently he missed your entire childhood and was sorry about that too. He said that to me too, she said softly. I don't think my sisters are open-minded enough to understand that. They have the self-satisfied attitudes of people who are content in their marriages. They have been critical of me for getting divorced and would have been of my father, I suspect. He thought so, too. There's not much to be served in forcing the point with them now, with him gone. If he was still alive, it might be different so that you could be accepted openly. But now, with him gone, there's not much in it for you.
He set up the bequest for you confidentially in such a way that they'll be unaware of it, and I'm under the obligation to follow his wishes and keep it confidential as his executor. So there's no cause for jealousy either, and there's more than enough for everyone. Maybe I'll see it differently with my sisters later, and it's up to you ultimately. You have a right to contact them if you want to, but given the hard line they've taken with me, I would warn you to be cautious with them. I can help you on that front if you want me to, maybe after the shock of his death has worn off. But what I wanted to do today was meet you and hold a hand out to you as your brother, and share with you the loss of our wonderful father. I'm here to help you in any way I can. Tears filled her eyes before she could answer him, and not knowing what else to do, she hugged him, and he held her. He felt sorry for her. He had heard all about the Brussels attack from their father, and about all that she had lost, and the severe injuries she'd sustained. He thought she was still beautiful, but the large square of gauze on her face suggested that all was not entirely well yet, and his father had said as much to him, that she had been severely disfigured in the explosion, as well as losing her mother. But he thought she was still spectacular looking, whatever was under the gauze. "Thank you, Charles," she said, when she let go of him. "Call me Chip," he smiled at her. "So now you have a big brother." He realized that she could have been his daughter. She was barely older than his sons. "I'd like you to meet my boys some day, your nephews." He smiled at her. He understood better now why his father had encouraged him to get divorced, despite his own political ambitions, rather than stay with a woman he no longer loved. He had lived the consequences of that himself and paid a high price for it. He had never been truly happy again after he and Marie-Hélène split up. "I don't know how to thank you. I was afraid you were going to warn me to stay away from all of you and had found out about me somehow."
"I only knew because my father told me. But when I saw you yesterday in church, I knew immediately that you were the one. You looked gorgeous, by the way."
He realized that she must have been an incredible model before the explosion. He didn't follow fashion, so didn't recognize her name when their father told him.
"I come to Paris once in a while. I'll look you up when I do. And you can call me in New York any time. Do you know what you're going to do now?"
"I don't." She shook her head. "I keep trying to figure it out. And if he left me anything, I want to do something in his memory and my mother's, something that helps people the way they would have wanted to."
"Will you be okay now that you're not modeling?"
He was concerned about her now, as their father had been. She had been through a lot for any human to survive.
"Yes, I had a good time doing it for 4 years, but I feel like I have to do something better now. Maybe help the victims of other terrorist attacks in Brussels, too. There are so many needy, wounded people in the world. I was lucky. I survived it. But many of the victims in Paris and Brussels are much worse off than I was."
He nodded, and found the thought of it appalling. The savagery of it was breathtaking. He had read some of the reports online after his father told him. He couldn't imagine how Véronique had lived through it.
"I'm coming back here again in 2.5 months for another surgery. Maybe we could get together then."
"Absolutely. And don't disappear now. We'll have some business matters to take care of soon."
He didn't tell her how much money it involved, and she didn't want to know yet. What he had shared with her and his acceptance meant far more to her. Her father had given her another gift, telling Chip the story, so Chip didn't discover it on his own after his father's death. He had united brother and sister with his blessing and told Chip what she meant to him.
"I'm easy to find," she smiled at him. "I'm living in my mother's apartment where I grew up, and I'm here for another 10 days until the doctors release me.
Dad gave me that number. It's where I called you. And I have the others too, including your cell phone in Paris."
They talked for another hour, and he told her stories about their father that helped her know him better and made her laugh and touched her. His sisters sounded a little difficult and more like their mother, and he didn't deny it. But he said he was close to them in spite of it, and he wanted to protect her from them. He didn't want them to be harsh with her, and they might. They were twice her age, and much tougher. Véronique seemed like a gentle person to him, in spite of all she had been through, and her enormous success as a model. She wasn't full of herself, or bitter, or angry, even about their father, who had ignored her for so long. She was just grateful for the time she had had with him, however brief, and now she was grateful for Chip's friendship and kindness to her. She left him outside the Carlisle and walked home in the crisp air. She had a lot to think about and a lot to be grateful for. Now she had a brother. She wasn't entirely alone in the world after all. Dr. Talbot and Dr. Dennis met with her 10 days later, and both were very pleased with what they saw. The scars on her arms and legs and the ones on her stomach were noticeably better, and some had almost disappeared. They weren't nearly as shocking, and the scars on her face had lightened remarkably. They weren't gone by any means, but they didn't appear as deep or as angry, and the smaller one near her jawline had vanished. Philip Talbot was very pleased with the results. He thought they would get even more improvement with the next surgery. They would never disappear completely, but eventually they would no longer be the first thing one saw about her. He wanted to give her a face she could live with comfortably, without shocking people. He didn't want her to be ashamed or want to hide. He said the same thing Doug had, that she was a beautiful woman with scars, but she was still spectacularly beautiful. She wasn't the scars. They were something that life and circumstances had added to her, but they didn't define her. She was beginning to see it differently herself. They kept gauze on her face just to protect it and told her she could take it off in a week. In all her injured areas, the skin was thinner now and had to be treated more carefully. They set a date for her next surgery in March, which oddly was on the anniversary of the attack in Brussels, but somehow that seemed fitting to her. She had dinner with Doug before she left and showed him the improvement, and he was impressed and encouraged for her. She told him about Chip and called Chip before she left. He told her to take care and he would contact her soon about financial matters. Then she flew home to Paris and had to face the same painful phenomenon she'd experienced before, expecting to see her mother when she walked into the apartment. And no one was there. Just the echo of her own footsteps resonating in the empty apartment. She wondered how long it would take her to get used to the reality that her mother was gone, and even in their familiar home, she was alone now. 2 days after she got home, she had a phone call that shocked her. A major French television network, the most important one, contacted her. They were preparing a documentary covering the anniversary of the attack in Brussels and honouring the surviving victims. They wanted to know if she would be the spokesperson and principal guest to narrate it. They were planning to interview all of the survivors, particularly the injured ones, many of whom, she learned, were still in hospitals, and many had not yet received government benefits, which represented a financial crisis for most of them. She was able to support herself with her savings and what her mother had left her, but many couldn't. She thought it was a noble project, but she told them flatly that there was no way she would participate in it. She preferred to recover quietly in the shadows. "Do you think that's fair to your fellow victims?" the producer who had called her said somewhat harshly. "You are an enormous presence. You have a name and a face that everyone recognises. You have a voice you can use to speak up on their behalf. Many of them don't. Some of them can't even speak now, or barely speak French. We've tracked them all down. We know where they are, so many in hospitals, and you could show what an event like this does to people. You even lost your own mother. When people hear the word injured, it conjures up a visit to the emergency room, and 2 hours later they go home. Some of these people have had over 70 surgeries. If I tell the story, I'm just another commentator. If you tell the story, everyone will listen. It doesn't matter if you cry or choke up, people will want to hear it from you. And on top of it, you're a beautiful woman." What he said was powerful and unnerved her. She felt anxious and panicked just listening to him. "I have very bad scars on my face," she said angrily. "I'm not making public appearances, and I'm still having surgeries myself." "That's my point. No one knows that. Are you still modelling?" "No, I can't." She sounded annoyed. She hated how pushy he was. "Exactly. There are scores of people who can no longer work. Nurses, secretaries,
teachers, mothers who have lost their arms and legs and can't take care of their children, a doctor who can no longer practice. Don't let the world think that it's over. It's not over for any of the survivors or the next victims, because it will happen again. Everyone believed that. Why me? Why do I have to be the one to do it? Because you're beautiful and people would rather look at you than someone else. They'll listen to you and those scars on your face give you a legitimate voice. You owe it to your fellow survivors to do it and all the victims, including your mother. She wanted to hang up on him when he said that, but she didn't. What he said was very compelling, but she didn't want it to be true. I'm not going to be the poster child for anti-terrorism, she said angrily. Why not? What better cause is there? We did a film on the Bataclan and the response was overwhelming. She had wanted to do something to help others and had some social importance, but this was too close to home. I'll think about it, she said, but didn't intend to. When do you want to do it? I'm having surgery in New York on the anniversary, she said smugly, thinking that would get her out of it. We want to start taping in a week. We have a lot of victims to see, and it'll take us about 6 weeks to do it. I'll let you know, she said, and was relieved to hang up. She hated how pushy he was, but his words had hit their mark and had a ring of truth to them. She wondered if he was right. Did she have an obligation to the other survivors? But why her? She wasn't convinced by his arguments, only haunted by them. He called and left messages for her for the next 5 days, and she didn't return his calls. She didn't want to think about it or be pressured into doing the show and exposing herself. She could think of dozens of reasons why she didn't want to do it. She lay awake thinking about it all one night, remembering the stories she had heard from the nurses about other victims, the countless people who had lost limbs, Cyril and her mother, and 30 others who had lost their lives. She got up and walked around the apartment and wound up in her mother's study and said out loud, Maman, what would you do? And then she knew, because her mother was a selfless person and would do what was right for the greater good. She tried to be honest about why she didn't want to do it, and she knew it was because she didn't want the world to see her with a ruined face, to see her as imperfect, when she had been so perfect before. Now she was flawed. But as Doug had said, it wasn't her fault any more than it was her mother's fault that she was dead. Others had done it and had died in the process. But others like them had to be brought to justice so it couldn't happen again, and those who had paid so dearly with an arm or a leg or their life deserved to be honoured and remembered. The show wasn't about her. It was about them. She went back to bed and slept peacefully for the next few hours, for the first time in days. In the morning, she called the producer and growled into the phone. I'll do it, she said, and he exclaimed with pleasure and thanked her. When do we start? She asked. As fast as we can, he answered. Call me then, she said, and hung up before she could change her mind. Chapter 14. The producers of the show called her 2 days later with the schedule. They were starting the following week. They were going to interview 47 of the injured victims, more than 30 of whom were in hospitals awaiting further surgeries, and they were going to interview 9 of the families of the victims who had died. She qualified as both. She told them that as often as possible she would prefer to be photographed or filmed from the left side of her face, but was willing to have the right side filmed too. Her one concession to vanity was that she hired a makeup artist she had worked with many times. He was a genius, and she asked him if he could at least somewhat improve her ugly scars. Even he couldn't make them disappear, but he could do a lot, and if she was going to be in a documentary that was going to be shown all over Europe and possibly the world, she had a right to look as decent as she could. The truth was still there and would be visible. The makeup artist, Jean-Louis, was happy to help, and he told her he'd work for the first week for free as his contribution to the project.
He normally charged a fortune, several thousand euros a day, and the network producing the show had a low budget for it, so she was grateful. She had told Doug what she was doing, and had been sure he'd tell her she was crazy to expose herself like that. Instead, he said he was proud of her. A little part of her was proud of herself too. It was going to be the hardest thing she'd ever done, but she was the voice for all the wounded, broken people who had barely survived, and the 32 who had died so needlessly. She went to the studio every day to study the research material on the victims so she could ask them intelligent questions and understand them better. She wanted to make a valid contribution. She told herself that when the project was over, she was not going to become the spokesperson for the victims of the bombing. She was only going to do this once, and told the producers that too. She had been lucky and had survived. This was her way of giving back. She was so busy she had no time to think of or do anything else. Gabriella came to Paris from Belgium, and Véronique had a quick lunch with her and no time to do anything else. She had a trial makeup session with Jean-Louis so he could see what would work best to tone down her scars. He stood looking furious while working on her face, and she thought he was angry at her. "Those bastards! You had the most perfect face I've ever worked on. You still do, but then they go and do this. This shit, this travesty. It's like putting graffiti on the Mona Lisa or carving it up with a knife. Everyone can still see how beautiful you are," he assured her, "but I hate them for what they did." "Maybe it was meant to teach me a lesson," she said, "that beauty, as we think of it, doesn't matter. One day I'll get old and I won't look like this anymore. So it happened early and I have to find other ways to be beautiful, from inside." He stared at her, shocked at what she said. "You're some kind of saint," he said. "No, but you have to find a way to live with it. That's true for the people who lost their limbs too. Some of them are remarkable in how they view it and are adjusting to it. It's the ones who are filled with hate or anger or self-pity who don't survive it, or not well. I still think you're a saint." When he made her up for the cameras, you could still see her scars, but they didn't look as raw or as frightening. Her recent surgery had calmed them down too. What was shocking was when the camera shot her from the left, and you saw the smooth perfection of her face, and then you saw the right, intersected by two deep scars, butchered by the blast. But when she smiled, you forgot everything else. The producers were thrilled to have her associated with the piece. Filming the victims was grueling. They cried. They told their stories. They showed their severed limbs and photographs of themselves before the explosion and right after. The stories were harrowing and heartbreaking, and the families who had lost loved ones tore your heart out with their grief. It made her think of Cyril and his parents again. They filmed the victims who had done well too, who were fighting to turn it around, to be more because of it, who were in rehab, in wheelchairs, who had gone back to jobs or had to find new ones that could accommodate their disabilities. They all said that government benefits had been slow and the red tape was endless. Many were in dire financial straits and unable to pay their rent or feed their kids if they could no longer work. What came through in most cases was how brave they were, how hard they were trying a year later to overcome their injuries, to move on, to be philosophical about it. Very few of them were angry or bitter. They talked about how they didn't want to let what had happened ruin their lives, how they refused to add hate to the mix, and were determined to go on and lead good lives. Véronique and the entire crew cried every day. It wasn't an emotional 6 weeks while they worked on the documentary. Véronique refused payment for it and contributed her fees to a victim's fund. The film had to be edited and would air on the anniversary of the attack. They had promised to send her a digital copy since she would be in the hospital in the States, having her second surgery then. She felt good about it, as though she had done something meaningful instead of moving furniture around in her apartment, shopping, or seeing friends, which she still wasn't doing except with Gabriella when she came from Brussels for the day, or with Doug in New York. Chip had sent her some papers, which she hadn't had time to look at carefully while she was working on the documentary. She finally sat down and read them one night. Her father had left her $2 million, which was a drop in the bucket compared to what he had left his other children, but she was stunned by his generosity, and still wanted to do something meaningful with it, something that would honour him and her mother. She had no idea what. Her mother had left her enough to live on. She also had the apartment, and what she had earned herself, which was invested. She didn't need an extravagant life. She wanted to put some good back in the world to counter all the hate. She was busy with post-production of the show right up until she left for New York. She had to do all the blood work again in case something had changed. Both doctors found her in good spirits and thought that all her scars looked better, even her face. She told them about the documentary she had been working on, and they were impressed. It was hard for her to believe that it had been a year since it happened. So much had changed in her life. She had lost her mother, found her father, and lost him, and met her brother. Her father had left her an enormous bequest. She had survived. She was going out in public without a mask. Her modelling career had ended abruptly, and she had worked on the documentary and met many of her fellow victims. There was a silent solidarity between them, like survivors of a war, or a ship sinking, or an act of hatred so enormous that no one could understand it. She'd had victories and defeats and losses. Just being alive was a victory, and learning to live with her scars was an act of courage. She talked to Dr. Dennis after he examined her scars, and she had told him more about the documentary. "Have you thought any more about coming to Africa to see the hospital there where I volunteer?" he asked her. "Not really. I've been so busy with the TV show I haven't had time to think, but I'd like to come." He had spent the month of February there and had come back to New York to work in March and was leaving again from mid-April to mid-June. "You could come in April when I go back," he suggested. "I'd like to be there to show you around. Or you could come in May, whatever works for you." She had nothing to do now that she had finished working on the TV show. "You're welcome to come whenever you like. Where we are is pretty remote and we don't get many visitors. Injured children are hard to look at and some people can't handle it," he said simply. He had already shown her which of her scars he would be working on next. Dr. Talbot had explained to her his part of the procedure on her face. She was pleased with the results so far, and the makeup for the show had worked well, making her face easier to look at for viewers. She thought about it that night, and told Dick Dennis the next day that she would go in April, a few days after he arrived there himself. He said the timing worked well for him. Her surgery was the next day, the anniversary of the attack on Zaventem, and of her mother's death as well, and Cyril's. She hadn't heard from his mother again, and didn't expect to. They had lost their only child, and she didn't sound as though she was doing well when she responded to Véronique's sympathy letter, nor was she warm toward Véronique, as though she had led him to his death. His mother needed someone to blame. Many of the survivors did, or some anyway. For the most part they were compassionate, but some of the parents were very bitter, which Véronique could understand. She had a hard night that night, remembering the little she did, still being conscious and waiting to be rescued, while they thought that she was dead and kept running past her, and not having the strength to call out to them, and the endless surgeries once she was out of the coma. She could still smell the odour of the explosion. Sometimes it filled her nostrils in nightmares. Others had mentioned it too, and the smell of blood and torn flesh all around them. She was wide awake when she had to leave for the hospital, and looked serious when her doctors saw her before the surgery. "Hard night?" Dick Dennis asked her. He suspected it would be, and she nodded. "Sometimes it still seems like it was yesterday." "A year isn't a long time," he said gently. "You've come a long way, Véronique. You're doing really well. I'm sorry we have to put you through another surgery. I hope this will be the last one." She wasn't determined to remove every scar, just the worst ones. Both he and Philip Talbot wanted to give her the best result they could, but didn't want to go to extremes. The scars on her face were the most important ones to work on because they affected how she felt about herself and how she interacted with others. She was still very young and had many years ahead of her. They wanted her to have the best life she could, with as few remnants of the explosion as possible. And she had been reclusive in the past year, which seemed a shame at her age. We're going to have a good time in Africa, Dick Dennis said to distract her when they put in the IV. There was some sedation in it, and she would begin to relax and get drowsy soon. She wasn't as frightened as she had been the first time. She knew what to expect now, and she trusted both her surgeons implicitly.
You're going to Africa with Dick?
Philip Talbot asked her, and she nodded with a sleepy smile.
Oh, God, bugs and snakes and creepy crawlies, he said, and they all laughed.
He dragged me there once. I'm a city boy, although it's a noble cause.
Veronique is gutsier than you are, Dick said, and his colleague laughed.
The attendants rolled her to the operating room a few minutes later, and she was fully unconscious shortly after. Both doctors looked at each other over her sleeping form. They wanted the very best for her. She was a great girl, and she deserved it. They didn't see the supermodel as she lay there. They saw the brave young woman she had become in the past year, and they had come to admire and respect so much. She had become a favourite patient for both of them, and they wanted to give her the best future they could, and that she deserved. She went through the same process as 3 months before, and she was back in the guest apartment 3 days later and was recovering even faster this time. 4 days after the anniversary, she checked her computer and saw that they had sent her the digital video of the show. She couldn't wait to see it and asked Doug if he wanted to watch it with her. His French was good enough to understand most of it, and she could translate the rest for him. He came with the pizza, and she downloaded it on her laptop. It was a 2-hour show, and neither of them said a word for the entire 2 hours. She saw him wipe his eyes several times, and she cried, even though she had done the interviews and knew the content. But the interviews were so moving that they made her cry every time. They couldn't even finish their pizza. They just sat listening to the people speaking. Everything they said was so heart-wrenching, especially the parents of people who had died, and the victims who had been so badly maimed they were unrecognizable. The film had been beautifully edited, and there were no editorial comments. It was all spoken by the subjects, which made it more powerful. Véronique had been respectful with her questions. She looked beautiful on camera most of the time, and at times her own scars were shocking when the camera caught her from certain angles. She winced when she saw her own images, and Doug squeezed her hand. They were both exhausted when they finished watching it and looked at each other.
"I don't know how you did those interviews," Doug said in hushed tones as he poured himself a glass of wine. She was still on pain meds, so she couldn't drink.
"The crew cried constantly, and so did I, but I have to admit, they did a good job with it. Sometimes it was just too much, hearing one tragedy after another, but they mixed them up pretty well."
"The whole thing is a tragedy," he said.
"I don't want to be that," she said, "a sad story that people tell. It was awful, and none of us will ever forget it. But we have to go on. I was luckier than a lot of people, and I'm not starving because I lost my job, but I don't want to be a tragic figure, or have people see me that way, or see myself that way."
"I don't see you as a tragic figure," he said, with a twinkle in his eye. "You're as big a pain in the ass as you ever were, even now that you're not a superstar." He was teasing her because she had never been difficult, and he had loved working with her.
"You're just a has-been now."
"Yeah, I know. That's why they put me on the show, so people would feel sorry for me," she retorted with spirit. But there was no question. She had lost a lot. They all had. Even those who had escaped unscathed had the trauma to live with, which was huge. One woman had said that she had no injuries, but she hadn't been able to leave her house in a year. She was too afraid of it happening again. It took a huge amount of courage to get past it and move forward. Véronique had fought hard for that, and still was. They talked about her trip to Africa for a while after that.
"How long are you going to stay?" he asked her.
"I don't know. A month, maybe two if I love it. I have nothing to rush home for. I'm going to fly from here." She couldn't face going home again. It killed her walking into the empty apartment, expecting her mother to be there. She wondered how long that would last. It hadn't gotten better yet. But Chip had told her he felt the same way about his father now when he had to go to the apartment to get something. There were such big people in life that their absence was sorely felt. She had spoken to Chip several times since she'd gotten back to New York,
and she was planning to see him for lunch when she felt better and wasn't still woozy from the drugs. She felt fine in the apartment, but she didn't feel up to going out yet. They had talked about the money she had inherited, and he was going to continue to invest it for her. She hadn't told Doug about it. It was just too much money, and it was embarrassing to talk to normal people about amounts like that. She was still shocked he had left it to her, but Chip seemed fine about it. He knew her now, and that she wasn't some gold digger, and his father had genuinely loved her mother, who had sacrificed so much for him. He didn't think his sisters would see it that way, and they would never know the way their father had set it up. He had been an estate and tax attorney before he was in politics, so had done it well. Doug stayed with Veronique until late that night, sensing that she didn't want to be alone after watching the video. The first-hand accounts brought all the details back to her, some of which she didn't even know until she worked on the film. The doctors and surgeons were always very discreet about the patients, and they had been about her too, which she had appreciated. "Don't stay in Africa too long," he said wistfully. "I'm going to miss you." "It sounds really interesting. The little hospital where Dr. Dennis works only treats children, and their injuries sound very severe, kind of like Brussels," she said thoughtfully. "I wonder if that will ever fade from our minds," she said with a little sigh. "Everything fades eventually, good and bad," he said. "Good fades faster and bad takes longer." She was trying not to hold on to the terrible memories, but there were so many of them, and with time and distance, the memories were clearer and the images so hard. She sat thinking about it all after Doug left. He had been such a good friend to her ever since it happened. The doctors were happy with the results again. More scars had disappeared on her legs and arms, although she still had many. The one on her stomach was less terrifying, as was the one on her ankle, where she had nearly lost her foot. That battle had been won before she even regained consciousness from the coma. She had pins in her ankle now, but didn't feel them. The scars on her face had gotten much softer, the sharp edges had been smoothed down, the scarlet colour had faded, and the area around them was normal skin tone now. There were still two deep grooves, but they didn't look as angry, or as though they had been inflicted with an axe. Everything was getting gentler with time. The doctors had warned her to stay out of the sun in Africa and wear a hat at all times, but Dick Dennis would be there if she had a problem, and she could always come home if it was serious, or back to New York to see Dr. Talbot. She saw Chip for lunch 2 days before she left, as promised. "You look terrific," he complimented her, and she didn't know if he meant her scars or her general appearance. She was wearing a pink sweater and coat with jeans. She'd had to buy clothes to wear in Africa because she didn't have the right things with her, or even own some of them. She was leaving some things at Doug's apartment that she couldn't use in Angola. "You look more relaxed," Chip said to her. "At least the surgery is behind me. This should be the last one, unless any of the shrapnel moves around, but I'm hoping it won't." She knew it could create some life-threatening situations if it did, and block an artery or a vital organ, even her heart. But what was left hadn't moved in a year, and hopefully never would. They were going to leave the pins in her ankle. There was no reason to take them out. They talked about how his congressional campaign was going, his kids, and his divorce. He liked talking to her, even though she was young. She had seen a lot of life, more than most people, between her modelling career and surviving a terrorist attack and a year of surgery. She was wise beyond her years, more than his own kids who were nearly the same age. She could tell he was upset about his divorce. His wife had gotten greedy, and they were battling over their house and his inheritance. "Be careful in Angola," he warned her, "and let me know how you are. I just found you. I don't want to lose you." He looked serious as he said it. "You won't." She smiled at him. She was made of strong stuff, and he knew it. His father had admired her for it, too. She left for the airport with a single suitcase, packed tightly with all the things Dick Dennis said she needed. Shorts, long jeans, heavy hiking boots despite the heat, every possible kind of insect repellent, sunscreen to protect her scars, and zinc oxide, pain medication if she needed it, antibiotics in case she got sick, long-sleeved shirts and a few T-shirts, a couple of simple peasant skirts. She didn't bring anything fancy, since she'd have no use for it. This was a rough and ready work trip in a small primitive village on rough terrain. He said that even the nuns wore hiking boots with their habits. He had left a few days earlier and would have time to settle in before she got there. He had arranged a room for her in the convent. The nurses lived there too. It all sounded like a great adventure. She rode to the airport in a cab, her passport in a small zippered pouch on her belt. She had enough money with her for emergencies, and for once she didn't even think about her scars or how anyone would react to them. As far as she knew, she had recovered from Zaventem. She felt free and could hardly wait to discover Angola. The nightmare of the past year was finally behind her. She was a free woman, heading for her future and all the surprises it had in store for her. She intended to reach out and grab them. She wasn't the same woman she'd been a year before, and she could sense that she wouldn't be the same after this trip either. Everything was new to her, and every day was a gift.